From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
And I'm Chad Beter.
And I'm Andrew Richards.
Welcome to Defrag Tool. So today...
we have finally arrived at ETW, XPerf.
On a very special episode of Defrag Tools.
Yeah, people have been clamoring for it, and I thought we were going to get lynched at some point for not getting around to it. But yeah. We're here.
And here we are. Yeah. So tell me about this tool and what you'd use it for.
It's Windows Performance Toolkit, WPT. It's used for performance. It's used to work out performance issues, hangs, high CPU. What else is it good for?
Why my machine is slow.
Yeah, disk issues, network issues, memory leaks.
You brought the right machine for it today.
Yeah.
I saw you're having some problems with your machine this morning, so...
The support case will be going to Defrag Show. Yeah. Gove can work it out.
Send an email to Gove.
And what operating systems was this for?
So it's been around for a while, and its previous names was always called the Windows Performance Toolkit, but a lot of people called it XPerf, and that was because the main program was called XPerf. It's existed since Vista 2008, but the tool actually worked if you X-copied it to lower OSs to 2003. And actually, ETW, the actual fundamental architecture in Windows, was introduced in 2000. So it's existed for a fair while. Obviously, as you go higher and higher, the more and more features you get. A thing called stack walking, which is the ability to see the stack at any point in time, was introduced in Vista 2008. It seems that we talk about Vista 2008 as the start of most architectures, and it is. I mean, Vista was an amazingly different OS comparative to XP and stuff. Once you get higher and higher, the one that released with Windows 8 is version 5 from memory, and we officially support that on Windows 7 and Windows 8. New UI system. The reason why we support it on those two is where .NET is available to run it. A lot of the tools are backwards compatible. So if you know the command line, you know, for Windows 8, that same command line will work all the way down with a couple of caveats, but mostly the basics are there all the way back down to 2000. Lots of programs can achieve the goal. Is this one of those things where there's like 10, 20 different ways of achieving the same thing? Because it's an infrastructure rather than a specific program. Mm-hmm. And so, Performance Monitor, Press Explorer, these guys are also the same thing. And they're pulling into the same data repository. So there's lots of ways of looking at it. And as you expect, there's lots of articles out there over its history describing it in all the different ways that you can describe it. So, I mean, what's your history with it? Have you used it over the years much? Or?
Using like ETW and XPerf? Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I probably started more with the XPerf side of things, and then I was always very frustrated as an XPerf user because so much of it was these convoluted command lines to start traces and things like that. Starting in Windows 8, now we have the new WPR utility, Windows Performance Recorder, which makes it much, much easier to get good traces without having to know these crazy command lines.
So what we're going to do is we're actually going to use the UI predominantly, but what we're going to do is go old school at the same time and show what the command line is that's equivalent of that. And that way you have, a better understanding of where the data comes from and what this one checkbox represents, because it represents this massive command line behind the scenes. And you'll be able to correlate the two much better. If you look around on the internet for articles, you actually don't find that much. It's kind of weird that something that's so good and so popular within Microsoft particularly, and has been talked about a bit at conferences and stuff, doesn't really have a public, adoption of it. And so I was amazed. I mean, I had never heard of it before I joined Microsoft, and I went to a training course on it, and I was like, oh my. Like, how did I not know this existed for the last 20 years?
Well, it's very powerful because, I mean, you can literally take a trace and see every single thread that the CPU executed over a certain time span, for example.
And it's accurate to the... was it microsecond, the one underneath millisecond? It's like, it's dot and nine decimal places of a second accurate. Yeah. So nearly down to the cycle of the CPU, you say, this program is, this cycle of the CPU did this, did this, did this. And you can, in amazing detail, get to the nth degree. And it's also the diversity of it, too. It's like, it's got, as I said, memory and CPU and hangs and disk, and it, things like, it knows where the physical disk head is on the platter, mm-hmm. right? And you can see that, you know what, this is slow because my disk is fragmented, and I'm having to move my head backwards and forward, and you can see the seek time between those things. And the reason why it exists is that Microsoft needed a true fundamental way of testing the OS's performance. And this is what we developed. We developed it for ourselves. Every time we build Windows, it goes into these performance gates, it runs these standard tests, and the performance is analyzed. And if we degrade from build, you have to explain why that extra code that took over that overhead has to be, you know, is justified. And everything from, like, I press start, how long it took from when I press start to when the screen rendered. Mm-hmm. You know, all these numbers are gathered, and that's how we gauge, you know, the successfulness of Windows and moving forward. And a lot of the features that we design into the next version of the OS are purely based on performance gates from the previous OS, and we go, you know what, we think that should be better. Yeah. That's what's...
Yeah, and what really, if you look at the way that Windows performance has improved from Vista to 7 to 8 and how every OS gets faster and faster, it's really because of tools like this that allow us to identify where we can improve and
what we can do
that really enables it.
So I was doing some search around, as I said, for these articles, and I found two that were very indicative of where we've been in the past and where we are now. Back in 2008, the Debug Ninja, which is an EE in our kind of like group at Microsoft.
And explain what an EE is.
So escalation engineer. So when you go through support, you start at support engineer. That's the person you'll get on the phone call at the start. And then that's called tier one. And then next level up, you're roughly their team leader. It's called TSL, team support leader. And they will triage and work out whether something's good or bad. And then tier three is when you're really in the serious level of support. Everything's conglomerated into much more like specialized support centers. That's level three, and it's called support escalation engineers. And they tend to be big centers in the US, big centers in India, and so we can follow and Europe, and so we can follow the sun with you. So that's where you get your heavy lifting 24/7 support. So when you've got your server down, we're taking care of you as you go around the globe. And these guys are the guys with the MCSDs, the MCSEs, the MCTSs, MCIT Pros. They've got every single certification in the world, and they just know.
They're the product experts.
Yeah. And then the last level is escalation engineers, with tier four, which is where we are. And that's the transition between product and code. It's got to the point where, by the product's normalness, we can't determine root cause, and we have to usually descend into code. And then we get asked you to make dump files, and we ask you to get performance toolkit traces.
Nice.
Based on whether it's a point in time issue, which is a dump, or if it's a point over time issue, which is what performance tracing is. And so once you get, and that's the top of the tree. Once you hit to escalation engineers, that's the highest you can go in support. And then we collaborate with the product group to make hot fixes. And we're the people who put in the paperwork to make a hot fix. So we find the issue and do the paperwork and all that stuff, and then out pops a Windows update.
Nice.
A little bit later. So always jobs open if you want a job. So Craig is one of the big EE big wigs around, and he wrote this article back in 2008 about XPerf. So as I said, this is before it got upgraded to WPR and WPA. We kind of showed this in one of the kernel shows where we went over ETW buffers in the kernel that you can pull out and get some historical data. And this is the tool I used a bit. And this is where we get the name XPerf from, because the viewer is called XPerf View, and the thing that records it is called XPerf. And we're going to go through a lot of this over the next couple of weeks. And then you can see that here's the command line that records it. So that's where the name XPerf comes from. Only last week, last week for us, PFE. So PFE is Premier Field Engineers, which is people who go out to a site when you have a big issue. And so we sometimes they go out for disasters. Sometimes it's proactive, and they might go, you've got to change these AD things. You need to get your backup done right, blah, blah, blah. And so PFEs do a lot of performance analysis, and they wrote this amazingly good blog series and released it last week. So there's multiple parts to it, lots of examples, lots of references, and it goes over the new tool, which came out in Windows 8, and which is the one we're going to go through as well. So those are kind of good. As you can expect, Channel 9, of course, has something. At the Build conference last year, actually the 2011 Build conference, we announced the toolkit, and so the PM for the performance toolkit did three speeches, and so we'll put all these links in the show notes.
Cool.
Okay.
So what I want to go through is, you know, how does ETW work? And that's what we're going to get to in this episode. We're not going to go into the UI. That will be the next episode. How does it get the data, and how do we get it to, like onto the disk and analyzable, right? And so I've got a picture here. It's a bit blurry, and I apologize for that, about the architecture of ETW. And what you need to know is there's three main players. There's controllers, providers, and consumers. And so we'll start with the providers because it's kind of like the base of everything. So in your code, say I write a function called foo, right? You can put an event, there's ETW APIs, and you can put an event saying, I am starting this function, foo, right? And at the end of the function, you say, I'm ending function, foo. So in essence, you've made two timestamps that if you compare the two, you have the duration of a foo operation, right? In the old ways, you would read a registry key and say, well, is the mask set to this bit and this thing? And you do all that type of thing, and you might have some global variable holding that, and it was kind of like very convoluted. It was also, different for every app and stuff like that. The provider models just streamlined the whole thing. What it did was that you always emit the event, right? And it goes into the central ETW code, and the ETW code decides whether anybody is interested in that event at this moment. And in your code, it's very simple. You just assume that logging is turned on. You always emit it no matter what the login level is. You specify what login level it is on the call and the strings and the details, but you always emit it. So then you have things called controllers, which is things like the xperf.exe, Windows Performance Recorder, Process Monitor, Process Explorer, Network Monitor, which is now called Microsoft Message Analyzer. There's lots of ETW controllers out there. And what they say is that provider, let's say it's the network provider, for the case of a network monitor, I am interested in events from you at the moment. And the consumer tells ETW, please enable the logging of data from this provider. And what happens is the provider, instead of just throwing away the information, now passes it through to the kernel, or the user mode, depending on what type of provider it is. And the kernel worries about the log files and how it's going to be kept. And there's you can specify how many buffers are available at any one time and stuff like that. And if you remember on the kernel episode on ETW, we did the WMI bang dump log. The dump log? Whatever it is. The one that lists all of the buffers that are currently running, right? And you get about 10 or 15 on Windows 8 just running out of the bag because we have these things turned on. The event log is one of them. We have other ones that look at plug and play. We have a lot of the ones that look at audio. There's lots of ones we just leave turned on all the time, just as analyzing ourselves. So that's kind of like the logging mechanism, which doesn't really have a name. And then you have consumers. They go into these log files, but you want to know what happened to them. So they either go out to disk, which is like this one out here, where you say to ETW, put it into memory. This is the size of your buffers, so you might have, say, a 200 megabyte buffer or 250.
So why put it into memory instead of a file?
Well, it's kind of there's multiple reasons. A, there's you don't want to do observation effects sometimes, right? And other things is duration, which probably Chad can talk about better. But with the observation effect, if you're trying to work out whether your disk is having issues, logging to disk at the same time isn't going to help your observation, right? Sure, you can put it onto another drive and do that type of thing, but there's some times where you just want to put it into memory, particularly when it's things like you're trying to track down interrupts or interrupt storms or slow DPCs, which is the things that like the workhorse of an interrupt, which is like the hardware asking, like a network packet coming in, or a mouse move coming in, or a keyboard coming in. You don't really want to be adding additional interrupts and DPCs to the system to skew the results.
Yeah.
And so you put it in memory, and then it goes, it stays in memory, and so you don't have this overhead of it then flushing out to disk. And if you set it up right, and we'll go through this on the command line showing how you can exactly set it up right, you can make it so it stays in memory, and then only when you press stop, it will flush out to disk. So you keep your observation effect away. From an approach point of view, what's it?
Well, another good reason to use a memory buffer rather than a disk buffer is the traces can get very big.
Yeah.
Especially if you think about what you're tracing and what you turn on. You know, if you have a trace where you're really logging like every single function the CPU executes, every single time we do a thread context switch, that trace can obviously get very big.
We're talking like millions of times a second.
Yeah.
Right. And so a lot of times, especially for sort of intermittent performance problems, you may want to kind of leave a trace running for a really long time. Mm-hmm. And you don't want this trace to get into, you know, hundreds of gigabytes, terabytes. I mean, it just becomes impossible to analyze. And so the other thing you can do is set up circular buffers in memory. So you're really only, you know, you set aside a certain amount of megabytes, and we just keep overwriting it.
Yeah.
And that way, when you do see the problem, you stop the trace, and you know that you've got the last X number of seconds. Mm-hmm. So that would be another good place to use memory log versus disk log. And there are certain cases where you have to use disk logging. For example, boot tracing. If we're like tracing a shutdown or a reboot, the memory tracing doesn't really work for that, obviously.
Yeah.
So you have to use a disk log. So there's.
So would the hard drive be fast enough anyway if you're capturing that much information?
Oh yeah, yeah.
So that's not a problem. That's not a bottleneck.
You'll generate. I usually run about 256 megabyte buffer. That's what my default scripts are. Mm-hmm. And in most things that I turn on, that gives me somewhere between 10 and about 45 seconds. So let's say that's 30 seconds. 30 into 256 is about 10. So you're only pushing out about 10 megabytes per second disk.
Yeah.
And most disks can sustain about 30 to 50. Mm-hmm. And SSD is obviously 200, 300. So it's not too bad. I mean, it's still a bit of an overhead. If you think about you're putting a third of that onto this, you have to be aware that there's a reason for it.
Yeah, yeah.
There may be cases where you're better off saving the trace to a separate physical disk than what you're actually interested in tracing.
Mm-hmm. I don't know about you, but I find that I tend to only ever do cyclic and just do short time things. I don't tend to do the long running ones very often.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe because I don't do that many memory leak cases, I guess.
Yeah, it probably just kind of depends on the types of issues you're doing.
Yeah.
I tend to do shorter ones too, but maybe just the kind of issues we work
on. Yeah, I think it's the OEM focus. It's like, why did my machine take 7 seconds to boot instead of 4?
Yeah.
Right, and so it kind of works for us. We do much more micro-based things. You do a lot of video things, which is, you know, I have a glitch. Okay, we had the glitch, and that's...
Yeah, and there's existing ETW audio tracing, for example, is pretty much always turned on, and so that you don't even really need to enable. You just go dump it.
So let's have a look at what the UI looks like very quickly, and what out of the box we make it really easy, right? And so the program, if we installed Performance Toolkit, we did this on another episode, I'm not going to repeat it, it'll be on your path. There's Windows Performance Recorder, which also comes up twice if you type WPR, same program. Have to run it elevated. This is well and truly looking at every single part of the OS.
Yeah.
So if we look at what comes out of the box, we haven't got this because we've run it once before, but it'll pop up with Disabled Paging Executive. We talked about that another day. Say yes, accept it. On Windows 8, you can do it kind of like dynamically. With Windows 7, you have to set a retro key by retro key and then reboot. You're saying that there's a command line, which I didn't know about?
Yeah, so there's a WPR command line version. This is the UI version, but there's also a command line version which has a switch to enable that, and then it'll prompt you to reboot on Windows 7.
Mm.
So if you want to force it that way, it's easier than going and editing the registry.
So do you do these check boxes with switches in the command line? Or how do you set
the
checkboxes?
Yeah, the command line has equivalent for all of these.
So this is kind of like the the high level version of it. It's much more simplistic versus the XPerf way of doing it.
Yeah.
I am actually going to show you the XPerf way of doing it because personally I think it's a better way to learn where the data truly came from, because it's a one-to-one relationship of what you see to what you ask for. But you know, in essence though, since this UI came out, I don't use anything else.
Yeah.
Also has some much better advantages with .NET because you need symbol files for to analyze the trace, and .NET programs only have symbols on the box that you collect because the program is compiled into the native compile, and we need the PDBs for that compilation object. So that's not going to be on any symbol server, and it's not going to be on any build server inside your network. And so it knows about that and actually will generate the PDBs required. And so if you do it the XPerf way, all the .NET stuff's missing, which means you don't get any information about those guys. So without a doubt, the WPR UI does a lot more for you than what the command line does for the XPerf, the old command line does for you.
So yeah. When I come in here for the first time, should I just check every checkbox?
Have you ever done that?
I've not tried that, but I would not recommend that.
Yeah.
That is a lot of data.
Yeah.
So your disk probably would not be able to catch up to keep up with that. And it would probably just bring your machine to just a crawl. Yeah.
So you're looking for as narrow as you can get to solve the problem that you're trying to work.
It's an observation thing. You want to be at least as invasive as possible. You are putting overhead on the system. This is not one of those things which is taking 1% CPU power.
Yeah.
It is hurting your box. And also, from purely from an analytical point of view, you're kicking yourself.
Yeah, it's too much data to go through. So
yeah. I mean, if I just run this for say 10 minutes, right? It's easy, you know, with a couple of these things switched, you could easily have 10, 50 gigabyte log file.
Yeah,
right? You need a significantly big machine to do it. So.
And you don't even need to check any of these boxes to get a trace, because there's a default profile that without any of these check boxes checked, you will still get a lot of data.
Yeah.
Okay.
So these are just for additional sort of specific kind of scenarios.
There's actually, and talking about scenarios, we'll go back to the basic ones next, but these four are a good example, right? These four know how to pick up audio glitches, video glitches, Internet Explorer things, and mini filter things, which is to do with the I/O stack and how things are going through the kernel to achieve things. So that will include things like antivirus and redirection of network packets and stuff like that. Audio glitches and video glitches were really good. You get these additional graphs that says, we noticed, you may not visually have noticed it, but we noticed in the code that we had a frame drop, or that there was, I don't know, what's an audio glitch look like?
Well, typically an audio glitch, you will just hear a little pop in the audio, or it'll cut out for a moment, and you may notice it, you may not, depending on what the audio sounded like at that point. But we will log it if it happened.
Yeah, and so there are these scenario-based ones. You actually can do add profiles and add your own scenarios. There is thousands of providers, and obviously we don't list even 1% of those in the UI. So if you know the provider exists, a lot of them are Microsoft internal, of course, because it's how we ship the product with its telemetry in it.
Yeah.
But you can add your own and get your own scenario stuff. The top ones are the big boys. And we're going to have a episode on every one of these. Maybe. Yeah, probably will. Give us feedback. I mean, if you want to have one on every single one of these, we'll do it. If you don't, then we'll just gloss over them.
Yeah.
So put it in the notes. CPU usage is pretty obvious. I mean, watch the CPU going up, going down. I don't know by default whether the CPU one's going to give you weight analysis, but it can tell you, let's say that some program is jammed and you get that you're not responding look to it.
Yeah.
It'll actually tell you the other program that it's waiting on, right? So you can follow the chain of events and back to the root cause. And so, Explorer might be jammed because it's trying to grab some COM object, and the COM object's has a multi-threading thing going on, and then that guy's trying to read a file while taking the lockout, and then it's trying to talk to the disk. Well, the disk might be blocked because it's got a big queue length, right? And so you can trace this chain of events back to each other. That's called weight analysis. CPU usage is usually just, hey, why am I pegging the CPU? This is, you know, it's a very common one we get. Why do we have so much usage? We do a lot of analysis of in OEM teams of why certain drivers have slowed down the system. So they might have some obfuscation filter driver that obfuscates code in the middle for some security reason, or you might have antivirus, or you might have whatever it is, BitLocker and Defender and all those things that are down the kernel, why they're running slow. Disk.io, that's much more of a physical, it's a physical disk concept.
That's the thing you were talking about where you could see like the head movement of the disk
and things like that. Good thing about Disk.io is when you ask for a disk operation, it goes into a queue, and the queue can get quite deep, you know, 10, 20. We say that if it's two times the value of spindles, so let's say you have a RAID set and there's five drives in it, and each of them is, say it's not RAID 5, but you know, there's five drives that can take traffic. We say five, and we're talking about, I don't care how many platters are in the physical drive, we're just talking about drive units, like Seagate or Western Digital block, times that by two. And so if you have five times two is 10, you should never see a queue length greater than 10. That's considered to be horrifically bad. And what you can do with the disk IOs is exactly when I asked my request what the queue length was, when I came out, what the queue length was, and the time between when I asked that and when I finished. So that includes, you know, everybody else being queued. And you also can see my proportion of the time on the disk. And so you can say, well, is the disk running slow because it's filling up a large proportion of the time, or is it running really fast but it's just oversaturated? And that's quite an important distinction to make, because that tells you whether your disk is or isn't bad, right? And whether you are or aren't saturating the disk subsystem with a queue length rather than the disk subsystem just running slow. File I/O is create file, write file, read file, close file, anything to do with opening a file. Great way of tracing just what files you're touching in an operating system. Obviously, Process Monitor is very equivalent to that, actually implemented in roughly the same way. It does it via a filter driver. This does it via ATW, but you achieve the same goal. Registry, same thing. Open registry, close registry. Network, every packet in and out. This is the provider that pulls in, that network monitor pulls in. So if you actually use this with this tool, put it to disk, then open the file and network monitor, it would know how to interpret that. It's got the right data in it. Heaps, it's a memory allocation within applications. Pull, memory allocation within the kernel. When you get your out-of-memory scenarios, that's the two to do. Virtual alloc, that's the raw way of asking for memory in an application rather than via a heap API. That's kind of, those two kind of like symbiotic. You probably won't put them on always at the same time. Power usage, what's my frequency of the thing? You know, how many cores are turned on? You know, how much of sleep state are we in and all that type of stuff? Obviously, that to us, that's a really important one these days because we want to make sure the PCs are using the least amount of power possible. GPU is kind of cool. You can, you know, we're not limited just to the CPU and the box. We can look at the GPU and see how much it's pegged. And this is where similar information comes into Presses Explorer about a year and a half ago, Mark added the GPU support, and it's roughly pulling it from the same data.
Yeah, I'd like to use that when I'm rendering a video on Premiere and make sure I'm using CUDA.
Yeah. So that's about half an hour. As I said, we'll go into these in more detail. We'll go into the command line, show the contrast of two, you know, old school versus new school. I'm still a command line person for this. My scripts work, and the script works on Windows 8, and it works all the way down to Windows 2003, so I have one script to rule them all. I don't worry about, you know, the new stuff too much.
I'm a GUI person. I hate those command line scripts.
Yeah, but you're trying to tell a customer that sometimes. Well, it's all right for yourself, but it's sometimes telling a customer to do something explicitly right.
Well, that's true. There's definitely a use for that. Command line.
And we'll go through what all these other ones over here are and how they translate to that architecture diagram we talked about. And we'll leave it there for this week.
All right. That's the show for this week. If you have questions, leave them underneath the show notes, or you can write us at defragtools@microsoft.com. See you next week.
Have a good week.
Thank you.